You are listening to The Conversation. Welcome. Hello, I am Michael Shaw. Thank you for being here. Rye Rockland County coming up shortly. Rye and I sat down in his studio in Lincoln Heights, not too far from the Five Points intersection, which I had never encountered before. It is a marvel of urban planning. We sat down in a studio in a couple of different places. At one point, we moved because the dance studio above him was getting going. So if you notice a slight transition, it's pretty subtle, but that's why we moved spots. Great conversation, though. I think you're going to find a lot of intrigue, enlightenment, and entertainment in it. And before we go to that, let me just say, as usual, I appreciate your spreading the word about the show. In fact, we have gotten fairly close with some recent podcasts of hitting a certain milestone in terms of downloads, plays. So spread the word about this one. I'm sure there are a lot of people who want to listen to Conversation with Rye, and maybe we can hit that milestone with this podcast. So let's do that together. And you can also support this show by donating. There is a PayPal button on the Podomatic homepage. Just Google The Conversation Podcast and you'll find it. And you can, of course, become a fan on Facebook, which is a way to spread visibility. If you haven't already become a fan and you are on Facebook, please do so. You can also follow on Twitter at Artist Podcast. You can also contact The Conversation Art Podcast at Gmail. All right, so that's about it for now. Thank you again for being here. Let's go find out what the sound of Rye's beard is like right now. Talk to you soon. I have to start by asking about your name. I mean, honestly, I think maybe on first impression, people maybe think of a hippie, you know, kind of a hippie parent with R-Y as right. Your first name. But then looking at you and then with the name, I mean, you must have Nordic ancestry, correct?
Oh, yeah. My mother is Dutch. Is that Nordic?
No.
Not Nordic.
Not quite.
Enough,
Sweden, right? Okay. Scandinavia is Nordic.
So my mother's Dutch. My father, his grandparents are from Russia, Russian Jew. Mother's Catholic, Dutch. And they moved, both of them moved to California, Los Angeles specifically, and ended up like falling in love on the set of a television commercial. And for whatever reason, they're friends with Rye Cooter. And well, actually, I think my mother was friends with Rye Cooter's wife, Susan. They're still, I don't know if they keep in touch at all, but they really like that name, Rye. And so they went.
So Rockland is a Jewish, is a Russian name?
It's like, Rockland, or they've changed the spelling, but I think R-O-C-H. I don't know how they ended it, but R-O-C-H probably was the original spelling.
Okay.
A more authentic
right.
spelling.
Right. Okay. Well, so much for that fantasy.
The Nordic fantasy. Yeah. The Nordic, I mean, I thought you were going to say, like, I come from hippie parents. I don't know if the ladies and gentlemen out there in Radioland can hear that I look like a hippie, because I kind of, can you hear my beard? Can you hear my long hair? You know.
Yeah, no, I mean, They either have to do the research right. on their own, or they just have to take my word okay. for it, basically, when it comes to that kind of thing.
So. As you paint a picture.
You haven't had a beard your whole adult life, correct? It's been probably, how many years has it been?
I've had a beard since 2003.
Yeah. Okay, almost a decade now.
Yeah.
And you haven't shaved it at all?
And I haven't shaved it.
Well, obviously you trim it.
I you know what? I shaved it off once.
Uh-huh.
In the summer of 04, and I realized I looked like it wasn't... This is a good look for me.
Yeah.
My father has a beard. It's a good look from my father. Not by coincidence.
Well, see, now you're bringing me back to the Nordic thing, because, I mean, I think combined with your hair, which has kind of a Nordic Viking kind of element to it, I mean, I think it was natural. So let's, we don't have, I don't want to bore people with this. People can go online, Google images, they will see you.
A slideshow.
Well, yeah, maybe our, the accompanying blog with this podcast will be, you know, profile. The history of your beard.
Right.
So, but I'm glad we're going back in time, because I was aware of you because you were getting a lot of exposure and press around Black Dragon all the way back in, you know, like 10 years ago now, right?
Right.
Like 2002. And you were like a junior or senior at UCLA?
Wait, I had just graduated from UCLA. And I had been going to school with my dear friend Nick Lowe, who also showed with me at the Black Dragon Society. And so we were, yeah, absolutely, we were both like these young guns at this, you know, up and hip art gallery in Chinatown. And we were asked to do a group show there. I think it was Nick Lowe, myself, Rob Tom, and Steve Canaday, maybe. It was like this four-person show, Big Trouble in Little China, I think we called it. And so it was an exciting time. I mean, there was a bit of cockiness. There was an article written about Nick and I in the LA Weekly, which is some of the press you were referring to. I was so embarrassed.
How
that
come?
Article. I was mortified by, because I just didn't, I just felt like the article portrayed me as being this kind of bragger, you know, like, oh, I just gave this perception that I was kind of like, we were these two, like,
you were cocky,
cocky dudes who were, yeah.
Did they quote you out of context, do you think?
Yeah, I felt like there. I mean, I felt misrepresented. So,
but the press didn't. But hurt I was naive. Probably, even though it was embarrassing.
It didn't hurt, but I'll tell you, this was the thing I was thinking about: is it's not all gravy, obviously, and as we've heard before, it can go terribly wrong. I think with any child star.
That was the whole structure of my bringing that up in the first place. Yeah.
You have the biggest problem with being a child star is your head is just going to get tweaked. Like, you don't have the kind of your roots. It's like a great wind blows your tree right off the. Yeah, you haven't planted your roots. So I think in that sense, it's really easy for myself and for my associates to be swayed by collectors' demands or how the press is perceiving us, or
that's kind of a good problem to have, though, isn't it? I mean, consider the alternatives.
Well, the one alternative would be you stay in your incubator, you go to grad school, you develop stronger roots, and then when you are able to set up shop and start showing with galleries, and you're confronted with these things, you're not like your practice isn't taken away from you in a way, which I think didn't happen to me, partly because although I showed with Black Dragon and I was, you know, featured in that article, I wasn't able to make a living with my art. So I had friends who I felt who were able to make enough money, and that's all they were doing. Meanwhile, I graduated UCLA. I was living with my father, working part-time at a elementary school, teaching after-school art, which was, like, awesome, you know.
Where?
Looking back on it, in Mar Vista, at Mar Vista Elementary.
No kidding.
Yeah, so I had, you know, and I have...
Where does your father live? Sorry to interrupt.
He lives in Well, now he lives in Marina Del Rey, but he lived in Mar Vista before. So it was, you know, easy commute. Yeah, so I was there and had my little studio in the back porch and was struggling. Like, I mean, I wanted to go pro. It's a great dream for all of us, and it wasn't happening for me. And I had a show in 2003 at the Black Dragon Society called Grounded for Life. And the work was different from what I make now in a sense. It was more fabrication heavy. It was like the objects in that show were kind of made more from the ground up. Like, and so I had that show in 03 kind of hoping that that would be my moment of beginning to make a living from my art. I could move out from my father's and just get a studio. But that didn't happen. You know, I think that they sold one piece or two pieces. They sold one piece from that show, you know, which was not gonna do it, didn't change anything for me. And so at that point I was like, okay, now I need to go to grad school because I want to fully invest myself in the arts and making work and thinking about work and talking about work. And
but you were in coming out of this scene that was creating these sort of ridiculously high and unrealistic expectations, don't you think? That you would go pro, like, immediately out of undergrad?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was... It's... I mean, in a way, it's persisted. Like, there's... It's a new... It's... I don't know what this newfangled climate is called or what it... I mean, but it's like... I mean, partly I think about how art is now a profession. Whereas before... I mean, I think before, back in the Eldon day... If you wanted to be an artist, it's like, great, but that's a very romantic and tough pursuit, and you're going to be poor. But nowadays, I feel like it's like, oh, you want to be an artist, huh? Oh, yeah, I heard they have art fairs. You can make a lot of money doing it. Like, there's a bit of a sea change where I feel like now it's, yeah, you can, there is a potential to go pro and make money. That's a more real, somewhat more realistic expectation. It's still not easy, obviously, but
exactly. Well, I like what you were starting to say earlier when we were off mic about the lesson learned, the retrospective perspective you have on the Black Dragon experience as far as your career. You want to see if you can replicate that.
Well, I kind of finally got a little clarity in my thinking about it, which was that when like we said, we're talking about earlier, is when I first started showing there, it wasn't a choice, really. It was like something, it was a wonderful thing to be able to be a part of, but it wasn't something I even really desired. Like, I really didn't. When I was in undergrad, I was just like, making work. I was excited about making work and this whole new world of art. I didn't know a ton about it. And so when I was asked to be part of the Black Dragon and to start showing there, it was an exciting place to be showing. But, it was something I kind of just fell into. And so, looking back on it now, like, there was a part of me even then that envied people who maybe chose to show with a gallery or had that kind of inner dialogue with themselves, like, where would I like to show, and what kind of context would best suit my work, what kind of artist would I fit in with, what kind of space does my work look good in? All these kinds of questions. And then, like, that process of talking with galleries and seeing who you get along with. Like, so for me, that none of that had happened because it was, like, straight out of school, I started showing with the Black Dragon. I mean, it was a nice space. I liked Roger. I liked Hubert. I liked Parker. But there was still part of me that, like, wanted to have that choice or have, you know, because in some ways the context was a bit strange. Although we all showed in UCLA, I thought my work was not the odd man out, but it wasn't painting. It wasn't, more figurative paining. It was...
Yeah, what did you say before? You're essentially the only sculpture among a bunch of painters who are painting...
Like boobs and butts, and I mean, but that's really, you know, Nick Lowe did an amazing painting of a mountain or a drawing of a mountain, and there was a lot more going on, but that's, yeah, the easiest thing to kind of remember.
But I guess, it sort of brings up the question, when you were in it, maybe you were just going with the flow more, and at a certain point, in retrospect, or maybe later on, as you know, of that whole period, you sort of realized, maybe you gain more clarity that, hey, this isn't really my sensibility.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's what I felt like about my whole early career, and I don't know necessarily if I would have done it differently, knowing what I know now. Is, yeah, you go with... I went with the flow. I mean, it's like when you're a young artist and you're asked, like, you kind of take the opportunities that are given to you. And then as you get older and you have a little more clout and you can start having, more say in where you want things to lead. I guess it's like, yeah, just momentum. It's like at an early stage, you're just pushing your car, trying to get the engine started. It doesn't matter what direction it's going in. It's just got to be going forward. And then once it gets a little momentum, then you can start turning the wheel.
Do you think if you had been selling work, you know, like crazy over, you know, the early 2000s, that you would not have gone to grad school, maybe?
Yeah, that was definitely... a possibility. I mean, because I if I had been selling work like hotcakes as a very young artist, I may not have gone to grad school.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I didn't sell work like hotcakes, because, like I said before, I think that could have been immensely problematic if I had built a career on work that wasn't exactly what I felt to be like. A way of working that I was really committed and excited about.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, let's skip ahead, because there are a couple things that I want to bring up and see what your take on them is. We're in early October now, just about 3 weeks out of the Made in LA show conclusion. But before that, what year was it that you were in the Whitney Biennial?
That was 08.
Okay, 08. So 2 years out of grad school, which you know, went to sort of mid-career in a sense, you got... So what was the... Tell us the story of that evolution. Because I've talked to a couple of people who've been in Whitney Biennials, maybe just one, but I'm interested to know kind of, you know, you get the call and how that whole process is.
Yeah. So I... Ry Rockland, how he got into the Whitney Biennial... So, I know, yeah, the intro to this tale.
You don't need to.
Yes. No, I mean, I'm like.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I mean, you can. You if that's how I would say. I wouldn't put it quite so formally. I would just say, I want the details. Right. Like,
well, I'm
when
kidding.
Did you first find out?
I'm kidding, but yeah. So, the story behind that is, I came out of grad school. I had my first show with Black Dragon in 07.
Your first post-grad school
Post-grad school show. But yeah. This was like... I felt... I was really happy with this show. I knew this show was like something I was really excited about. Looked great. I think it's one of my... Yeah, really great... Good show of mine. Like, you know, even to date. So I had just had a... I went on a residency in Bangkok, Thailand. And I felt like some... I say that only because I felt like that had a great influence on the work that ended up becoming part of the show at the Black Dragon. So anyway, I came off the residency.
How did the residency come about, by the way?
A guy, Kata, he was a grad student at UCLA when I was an undergrad, and then he was from Thailand, and he moved back to Thailand and became a teacher at Bangkok University, and then he was put in charge of putting together this residency program with artists from LA. Or basically, they were like, hey, Kata, you know artists in LA, like, why don't you ask some of those guys to come out here? And so, like, Hannah Greeley did it, Stephen Simon did it, who is works at UCLA in the sculpture department. I did it. So there's a few of us that had made that connection with Kata and ended up going to Thailand. So in that experience, it was like it had this funky little space, and I didn't really know anybody, and it was hard for me to get material, so I basically would once in a while go to the junkyard and get stuff from the junkyard and bring it into the studio. And I remember I was in there just like literally shuffling these things around and seeing how the objects were fitting together, and I thought that was like such a wonderful way of working, because I was so limited. So I felt like that process of me just kind of shuffling things around informed a lot of the work that ended up becoming part of the show in 07. So the show in 07 at Black Dragon Society, Charles Long saw the show and really liked the show, and then he mentioned to some of his associates that I had done a good show, and somehow the word spread enough that Shamim Momum, who was one of the curators of the 08 Biennial, I was now on her radar as a result, I think, of my show at the Black Dragon. So she asked me if I could do a studio visit, and of course I was thrilled. And it so happened the week that she was coming to LA to do these studio visits, the Black Dragon Society was open. It was like in between shows, so Parker helped facilitate the reinstallation of my show.
Wow.
In the space that it was. So it was, I think it wasn't exactly the same, but it was ostensibly that show. And Shamim saw the show, and yeah, I mean, she liked it enough. And then a few months later, I got the call, and I was, you know, my Jerry Maguire moment or whatever with the fist pump. It was exciting. So,
is that a segue to talking about your trophies, by the way, making a sports metaphor? Right.
Yeah.
And how far ahead of the actual show was all that?
That was, I think, I can't remember the exact dates.
But was it like a good half year?
Yeah, it was a good half year.
Yeah.
And then the work, you know, which is, I think is a tricky thing, is like, I've talked about this before, but the work I made for the biennial, I think was really exciting. Well, basically, the work, it wasn't, like, Shamim was open for me to make new work. So she had seen this work that I had done for the show at Black Dragon, and it was, I thought that work was like super strong, and so but I also was excited to make new work for the show. And it was like, so then there was this process of like coming up with new work and producing that for the show. And I was gonna say, it's funny because it's like not a gamble, but it's like, you know, it's interesting for her that she allowed something else to happen. Like, that wasn't like, we want this, this, and this. It was like,
she was taking a chance.
Yeah, she was taking a chance. And so that was exciting as well, to kind of perform knowing that the work was going to be, like, to make work. It was interesting to make work knowing where it was going. Like, which I don't know if it, in a way it's less pure, because you're like, this piece is going to be great because it's for the Whitney Biennial, whereas maybe it's
so you're know. Kind of psyching yourself up with the work as you're making it.
Yeah,
the show. Yeah,
yeah,
but it still ended up coming out okay. So
it came out okay. Yeah.
So when the show opened, and you know, and things started to, you know, people ascended upon it. Did you have a sense at all that this was like your world debut in a sense, or at least New York debut, or you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a big moment. Like, it was something that I think I had been wanting to be a part of ever since I heard of it. I mean, you know, it's the Whitney Biennial, so it was exciting. But I was, and tons of people saw that work. I mean, it's a very well attended show, and I don't know if people remember it to this day, but you know, maybe a year or two ago, like, or maybe even to this day, some New Yorker who hadn't been familiar with my work, I had the one piece I could have, like, remind them is my Bed of Nails. So if they're like, I was like, oh yeah, I was in the Whitney Biennial. Oh really, what piece is yours? Oh, it was that Bed of Nails on the, remember
describe,
that piece?
Describe it while you're
so,
at it.
Yeah, so the piece is an old what's it called, an old bed spring, like just the raw metal bed spring that you'd have back in the day underneath your mattress or something. And so I stretched a window screen over the top of that bed spring and then dropped nails through every other hole in the window screen. So it basically was a reverse bed of nails. So the top surface of the bed spring looked as if it were sequined because all the nails were hanging down. And so that piece was the most iconic piece of mine in the biennial. And it was the one piece that I had made before I had found out I was even in.
Interesting.
That was that, so, yeah, that's...
That's an interesting takeaway, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think, a particularly successful sculpture of mine for whatever reason. I mean,
yeah.
You never know what's going to... Yeah, it's hard to tell what's really.
What do you feel
work.
Like, in retrospect, the results of the being in the show, the bump, if you will, from the show was
the post convention bump. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
The takeaway was, I did not go from zero to hero. You know, there's this.
Well, you weren't a zero at that time, obviously.
Well.
Because you had been in a number of shows.
I had been in a number of shows. I guess...
And as you yourself said, you had a really strong show the year before, you know, that got you that opportunity.
Yeah,
so
in LA.
I mean,
it was no... Like, I mean, there's this... Yeah, in a way, I think people were made aware of my work in New York, which was important and helpful in my
essentially
career.
For the first time. For many people.
Yeah, but but it wasn't... I don't... Like, I feel like there's maybe this idealization that you'd really catch fire or something, like, from the Whitney, then next thing you know, you have a gallery, and three galleries in Europe, and, like, you have a big New York gallery. Like, so it was slow, you know? It's like, things happened, but they're... It wasn't this immediate kind of game-changing thing. Like, still gotta hustle, you know? It's not like people are knocking down the doors wanting work. It was...
Yeah, I mean, Alice Konitz, who's also a sculptor, who I talked to, who was in the biennial. Was it that year as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, it was in...
She basically said, and if you people can go back and listen to it, she basically said, you know, essentially nothing changed, really, for her. I mean, that was...
Right.
That was a really... big year for her. I think, you know, she had a solo show in LA as well, but as far as a bump for her, I mean, she basically said there wasn't one. And I think what you're saying is a reflection of what I've been talking about on and off mic with people, maybe more off mic with people lately, which is this idea that there is no, you know, the tastemakers, it's a complicated network, and things don't just turn over in a day. You know, it's like reviews, you know, and shows, and all these things are all part of this ongoing process. And the Whitney Biennial, as potentially big as it has been, as it can be for some people, and has been for some people, is generally as you describe it.
Right. Right. I mean, there's Yeah, that's true. I mean, there's exceptions, and it's like we all look. It's hard sometimes not to look at those exceptions and be like, "That's what I want to happen to me." Is yeah, you just like blow up, which can happen and does happen. But then there's that like this great, you know, piece of wisdom: slow and steady wins the race. So
that's right. Where does that come from? Is
the
that a sports
tortoise
saying?
And the hare? I mean, it's.
That,
like,
I guess so. Yeah, that's probably
it's
it.
Kind of.
I overshot that one. I think a little bit.
No, but
in imagining.
Yeah.
I did
the right.
Yeah. Well, let me. This is a kind of a potentially intriguing question. How cognizant were you of the other artists in the show, and was there at all? Was it more of a? Would you say a competitive kind of perception of it, or was it more, hey, we're all in this together, isn't this exciting, kind of big happy family kind of
well
thing?
That was, I mean, that I was particularly enjoyed in retrospect the gallery, the artists only cocktail party that was part of the Whitney Banner. So we had these invitations, it's like, please join us for a very exclusive cocktail party of artists only. You can't even invite your spouse, your kid, whatever. No one else is invited. But
were curators
the
there from the show?
Yeah. So the curators
all artists
are
except
there.
The curators. Yeah.
Yeah. All the artists and the curators of the show and, you know, other bigwigs at the Whitney.
Right.
Were there, and it was funny because like. I had this thing like, okay, I made it. I'm going to this party and I'm part of this party. And then once I'm there, I immediately was at the bottom of the totem pole again. So it was like the never ending.
Right.
Yeah, there's the never ending rung of on the ladder. So it's like, okay, back
well,
at the bottom.
That's kind of refreshing to hear in a perverse way, but I would imagine that for a lot of people, a lot of artists, I mean, you kind of seem like you're right on the middle of the fence of introvert and extrovert. Is that about true?
Probably, yeah.
So, but what I was getting at is that I would imagine for a lot of artists going to a big party like that, you know, their insecurities are just like through the roof, you know. But the whole... where do you place yourself, you know, in this? Was there anything particular, though, that made you feel that way? Or was it just kind of like, this is a intense social gathering?
Yeah, well, it's just like, there's, you know, when you go to those things, or even when you go to openings or whatever, like, you can tell who people really want to talk to. Like, there's the people who have the power. So, who are those people? People talking to. Well, it wasn't really me. Like I got highs and hellos and sweet kisses on the cheek, but I wasn't like, so Rye, how do you did it, you know? It's like that was happening to who was like, well, John Baldessari was in the show, so maybe that was happening to John, although I can't even remember him being at that party.
Yeah.
But you know, whoever is,
what other LA artists were,
well,
were there?
Amanda Ross Ho.
So she was probably getting that, right?
I don't know if she was.
Okay.
I mean, she'd be getting it now, probably, because she's like...
But then it was a different story.
Killing
sure.
it.
Just 4 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, at the time, you know, it was kind of... We're both like the rookies or whatever. Like, we were the younger... We were the... We didn't have big careers yet or whatever. I mean, who else was like... Or Alice Konitz, or she was in that too, or Jedediah Caesar was in that.
Could all of you guys, though, you sculptors all, could you have all bonded on being, you know, feeling kind of like all sort of at the bottom of the heap?
I don't know, maybe.
Or were you just all fending for yourselves?
You know what, I can't remember exactly, like, talking with Jed or Alice or Amanda at that opening. I had that party.
Right.
I remember talking to Francis Stark for a while. But yeah, it was... I don't know. It was... We could have. I mean, but we didn't. Or at least I wasn't part of that.
I mean, the reason, I think it's important to note, the reason we're kind of going on so long about this, I'm anticipating people going, can you move on already? Is because I think it's really important to recognize in seminal career moments the, you know, the potential flip side of one's fantasy. You know what I mean?
Like the
golden ring is an ever elusive thing.
Right.
I mean, I think a lot of people fantasize, you know, once they're in the Whitney Biennial, it's like
cruise control.
Well, no, it's like I can die, and you know, now. I mean, it's like, what else do I need to do? You know, I'm just going to go, and I mean, I don't know how many people when they fantasize about being in the Biennial think about the party, but you know what I mean. I think there's a certain value in deconstructing or pointing out the what you don't fantasize about, glamorous and glorious achievements.
I was just gonna say there's still the Venice Biennial, you know, Biennale.
Yeah, of course. I'm not saying it's the pinnacle of art, but right. For an American right. artist, I mean, it's like, you know, they're not fantasizing about the Venice Biennale.
Right. Well. I don't know if it's a relief. It's just, it's like, in a way, it's an eye opener. It's like I was talking about before of Henry Dorringer and being able to just make work in your basement and not worry about kind of where you are on the totem pole or, you know, staying present in your relationship to the work, staying present in your relationship with others and the conversations you're having and the air you're breathing, all that stuff. It's like, I think that, you know, that experience, in some ways it puts all that in perspective. Like, no matter, I mean, I would imagine kind of no matter where you, like, the grass is always greener thing. It's, yeah, no matter how high you get and your field, I'm sure there's some kind of competitive, but that being said, it was still great. I mean, yeah, it was exciting.
Let's not minimize
this. It's helped me.
Yeah,
it's helped me, and yeah. There's a lot more people who know my work. I mean, it's like, duh, it's the Whitney Biennial. So
yeah, you know. Well, should we skip ahead then to Made in LA? I mean, we're obviously leaving a lot out here, but I think it should be interesting maybe to look at them side by side. So just to set this up a little bit, you have basically a solo show amount of work in the show at the Barnstall gallery site. And what I've been thinking about it, I thought that the sort of car wash, you know, your biggest piece, the sort of car wash totem type piece, that is so tall that I just, you know, I'm into details, and I think I wonder on a practical level, wasn't that actually, would that have been too big to actually fit in the Hammer space?
Maybe. The car wash totem in which you're referring to is a piece called Breath Deep, and it's a tree. It's like this, it's a tree made out of copper pipes that are kind of casually bent. And hanging from those pipes is VHS tape, which then blows in the wind as the viewers pass through the gallery space. But yeah.
So you don't like my car wash analogy?
I do. When you walk through that VHS tape, it is.
Are
like,
you allowed to walk through
it? Yeah.
I don't think the people there were encouraging anybody to do that when I was there.
Well, that work. I like that work in the sense it's kind of indestructible because you walk through it. If somebody really pulled on it, the VHS tape would break. You can glue another strand on it. I felt like I wasn't worried about that work at all, which was nice. Yeah, so that when I was talking, I worked with Laurie Furstenberg on. She was like my point person. She was the curator, I think, who put me into that. Or reached out to me. You know, I assume they made decisions collectively.
But do you think that each artist sort of hooked up with a point person?
I think so. Yeah, that was my impression. And Laurie was my point person. I mean, she was the one I talked to the most, and she was the one who first did the studio visit with me along with Cesar Garcia. But yeah, so Lori was the one who I had was talking as we got further down the line with like what was actually going to end up being in the show. I was, you know, thought about this. I wanted to do this massive trio. It's like 15 feet by 15 feet by 15 feet. So that space, I don't think there would, it could have been that space in particular in Barnsdall, this in this middle of Barnsdall where there's these doors that open up to the space from the outside, as well as having like the natural light coming in from the glass doors and windows. I think that helps the piece a ton, and in a way I didn't, there was no space comparable in the Hammer that I think could, that would have suited that work as well as it did at Barnsdall.
Right.
So, I mean, that at my Made in LA experience, I thought was, I felt more grown up. I mean, I felt like I had a better kind of grasp as like what I thought was a possibility for the show. Yeah, it was nice. I mean, it was really nice to be able to work on that with Lori and be able to kind of see that vision come to be and exist.
Was there a artist-only party?
There was. And that I felt like we all... That was a nice party. I mean, maybe it's LA. It's like, I feel like New York, it's not high society, but I feel like that thing of in New York,
being on the Upper East Side and the Whitney with all that tradition.
Yeah, it's like, it's kind of much, yeah, it's, yeah, it's like,
and people from all over the world, their country. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's maybe more of like this lineage and history of like, who's here and who's there and how'd you get, you know, but in the Made in LA artist party, I just felt like it was pretty fun, and you know, it was much more laid back and
not as tense.
Yeah, and also I knew almost everybody, like, because it's much more of a, I don't know, I felt like there were a lot of other artists in the show that were of my generation, which was the Whitney. It was a more multi-generational thing, so
yeah. Did you have a sense that at any time the Made in LA show's sort of subtext or premise was that kind of artists who maybe were underexposed in town? Or it sounds like you're probably going to say no to that, so I'm going to give you the other line, which I've been fed about it, which is it's this slice of LA in this one particular moment.
Well, I think they made... I actually thought that was somewhat explicit in the first thing, which is that they wanted to show artists that maybe weren't the more obvious choices. Like, that there was a kind of... that there were artists in LA who were engaged in immensely interesting practices that people hadn't been exposed to, and I thought that was kind of the curator's conceit, or what, like that was an actual thing. It's not, we're not making it up. That was
what I thought as well. And I feel like there are a number of artists in this show who don't really fall into that category, including you, actually.
Right, and that was it's been pointed out to me that I didn't quite.
With bitterness or frustration at all, or just sort of even keeled?
I'm just, you know, for whatever reason, I'm happy I was able to slip in there. I mean, it was a good experience, I think, all around. And so, but you know, I guess I don't know how that stuff works exactly, and I think there's exceptions to every rule. So, you know,
yeah. Well, it's kind of why I have adapted. I don't really like that latter one I put about the slice of LA at a given moment. I would prefer something like artists who are either unknown or have been known for a while, but maybe kind of a little bit under the radar.
Right.
You know, who are kind of coming together.
Yeah, just on my own defense, I don't think, I mean, I'm known, but there's other artists that they could have put in that show that are also known, but really known, or make, like, more obvious. Like, I feel like you said, I'm on the fence between extrovert and introvert. It's in the same way I'm on the fence between known and unknown. Like,
right.
I'm, so...
Well, not anymore.
Well, there's, you know, progress is always to be made, but the career hasn't hit overdrive by any means, you know? It's like, still plodding along, gotta get your hustle on every, you know, all the time.
How so?
Well, making, just, you know, doing... We gotta make work for the fairs, gotta, like... work on the next show. I mean, it's like, it doesn't seem like it's ever like...
What fairs are you doing this
season?
People
are knocking down
the
doors
way.
And
yeah.
Just like, it's not like everything I make is flying off the shelves now.
No, that's not what but I wasn't implying that by saying what I said.
No, I know.
Yeah.
I think, but to me, that's partly what...
That's what comes
like,
up.
Like, I want, like, that's, there's a desire for it to just be... Yeah, easier.
That's one of the grass is always greener
right,
places, which
right.
is where you have a successful career, but not everything is flying off the shelves.
So, I was going to say, though, with the Made in LA, I guess I could see that partly their conceit of having them be artists who were maybe under the radar, I think there's part of that has to do also with that the practices in that show seem kind of not esoteric, but like in self-involved, or like they were like part of that show was like that these artists are out in LA, and the great part of the great thing of LA is you can kind of disappear into your own kind of netherworld of art making and be slightly less connected to some kind of greater.
Right.
Organism and dialogue. So I think, and that's true with a lot of the, I mean, maybe those two things can kind of go hand in hand. It's like,
right.
These practices are, you know, have their own kind of, it's hard, I can't, like, that they're kind of on their own trip. Yeah. And so in being on your own trip, maybe you're not, like, you know, seen quite as clearly. You're off in the woods,
right?
So
okay.
Anyway,
well, we haven't talked at all about we mentioned the we just got on the introvert extrovert thing, and it made me realize that we hadn't talked personally about you at all. Is there anything that you want people to know about you personally? I mean, I'll start by saying, and then you, as I'm asking, you can think about in the back of your mind about other things that you want to. You may or may not want to put out there, but do you have a gold wedding band on your wedding finger? So
right.
So you're a proudly married guy, because you refer to your wife as your sweetheart.
Yeah, well, I refer to my wife as my sweetheart, but I just said my wife, which isn't the case. Technically, we're not married. I like to say we're almost married. So Carolyn, who's in a band called Bouquet. Quick plug, they're amazing.
Yeah, no, we can put a link.
Please do, yeah, Bouquet Music. Anyway, so she's on tour right now, but we are almost married in the sense that we had a commitment ceremony. We had invited some of our friends, mostly family, to her parents' backyard, and we talked about how much we loved each other, and other people talked about the love we have for each other, and we exchanged rings, but we didn't sign any of the paperwork. And partly, mainly, we didn't do any of that paperwork is because of Proposition 8 and the fact that I think it's almost overturned, but our gay brothers and sisters can't get married. So
you were partially doing a protest.
Yeah,
match.
It was a protest. And I mean, Carol, I will say it's something I'm so happy that Carolyn insisted on.
Does she have people particularly close in her life that inspire that?
Yeah, her brother is gay. and amazing. And but yeah, it was just like it, and I think it's great if people get married, and I don't really like look down on anyone who's married, but I also think it is kind of a funny feeling that it's something that I can do, but like someone who's very dear to me can't do. So like I said, I think that's going to change. Yeah. I mean, it already, I think the Supreme Court has ruled against it, and I'm not sure what the status is, but it's not, I don't think it's quite fully overturned.
Sure.
But,
well, how long have you guys been committed?
We've been, since May 24th of 2009.
Wait, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So 3.5 years, basically.
Yeah.
And are you still in your honeymoon phase?
We've been, well, I suppose it's certainly dreamy.
I mean, yeah, that's a honeymoon phase. Wow. You were really soulmates or something to that effect, perhaps, if you don't believe in that word.
Falling in love with Carolyn is absolutely one of the greatest things that ever happened to me. And I think, you know, it's helped my art practice too, I think. It's been all around.
How long were you together before you had the ceremony?
Since 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Or 2004. No, 2004 was when we kind of committed, to being boyfriend and girlfriend. Summer.
Had you known each other? Had you known each other long before that?
Yeah, a little. We had she's from the Bay Area. I'm from LA, born and raised. She was born, she's from Berkeley. So we met at a party in LA, and then we hit it off, and then we communicated a long distance, you know.
Oh, she was just down.
Just for the weekend, and like I said, we totally hit it off, and then it took a while for me to finally go up there, which was in the summer of 2004, and visit her. And at that point, it was kind of like, okay, yeah, this is really
long distance relationship.
Yeah, we're gonna do this. And then we had a long distance relationship till 2007, and she. Because I was in grad school, and she went to Germany, and she was doing a printmaking residency,
right,
in Europe. And so, basically, it wasn't until like 2007 that she moved down here, and then we got our place together. And she's been down here ever since. And you know,
and she just you just told me when I got here that she just went on tour. How long is that going to be?
Well, she's gone for another 10 days. It's like a 2-week tour she's doing with this band called Mount Eerie.
Right.
And it's the guy from The Microphones.
I'm more interested in, you know, what it's like for you guys when you spend time apart, you know, that kind of
thing. Well, I think that maybe we're good at that to some degree, or if we've had
because you started off that way. That's right. Got it.
So, I mean, I think for both of us, it's like, absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Right.
You know, but we're both like, I mean, it's great because in some ways we're really lucky because we're both passionate about what we do outside of each, our love for each other. So when we're both like really working hard on our projects, it's like, there's an understanding that's like no hurt feelings or whatever,
right.
But it's also really great because we're in different fields, so it's like she's the musician, I'm the artist, and we're not competing for the same slots. And I think that, you know,
it's, I appreciate that dynamic, because I have talked to a lot of people who are in artist couples, and they all, you know, seem to think it's great, and I'm a little skeptical of that, but you know, whatever.
You know,
well, if it works, it works.
Yeah.
You probably know a lot of artist couples.
Yeah, I do know a lot of artist couples, and they seem to be managing just fine. I know for me, I'm pretty sensitive and competitive, so
a lethal combination.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, our love, I'm sure, would trump whatever kind of feelings that would arise from, like, her getting a studio visit and me not getting the studio, whatever it would be, but it would definitely be, I'm happy we're not having to face some of those battles or hurdles or whatever.
Right. So when you guys met, you had the beard, right?
No, that's a good, very good question. I'm happy to say when she first met me, I did not have the beard. So she knows, you know, what I look like without the beard. So it's like, I feel like there's some kind of honesty there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a before and after, yeah. And she's been there.
Yeah, she's happy with both.
Excellent.
Which is great.
Well, see what I did? I brought us back to where we started.
Very nice.
Are you good, Rye?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you.
And
we're out. Okay, I'm back. That is it. Did you enjoy that? I think that was pretty good. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you come on back. Again, you know, feel free to support the show financially, becoming a fan on Facebook, following on Twitter, spreading the word, letting me know if there's anything I can do to make your experience better. Thank you for being here again, and I will talk to you soon. See you next time. Nope, no. Talk to you next time. Ciao.